From Massachusetts to Arizona, Missouri to Illinois, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, federal tax subsidies for customers purchasing electric cars are about to end, and they should. Phil Kirpin of American Commitment is here to talk about why. Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats are now in control of the U.S. House of Representatives. Does this mean government gridlock? Andy Roth of the Club for Growth has the real story. An overzealous professional licensure board in Oregon has been reined in by a federal judge. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details from Sam Gedge of the Institute for Justice. And it's been 20 years since the impeachment of President Bill Clinton. Is history about to repeat itself? Dr. Paul Kengor from the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Seeking to promote the development and sale of electric-powered vehicles, Congress established a federal tax credit to make the cars more affordable. For some manufacturers, those tax credits are about to expire. Phil Kirpin is president of American Commitment. He's here to explain why Congress should not reauthorize those tax credits. Phil, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Phil, electric vehicles are at least becoming more talked about, if not more common. There are some federal government subsidies, tax credits for electric vehicles. What is the current policy?
Well, there are a variety of direct grants to the automakers, and there are a number of other things, but probably the most significant and best known of the federal subsidies is the $7,500 tax credit that purchasers of battery electric vehicles get, and there's a lesser amount for hybrid electric vehicles, and that subsidy has a built-in phase-out schedule. The way it was designed, and it was first passed about 10 or 12 years ago, the way it was designed, each manufacturer gets the subsidy, gets the tax credit for purchasers for 200,000 vehicles. Then they go into a phase-out of 1 year where they get 6 months with half the credit amount and then 6 months with a quarter of the credit amount, and then it's gone. And Tesla is already in the phase-out. So right now, if you bought a Tesla, you wouldn't get the $7,500. You'd get $3,750 instead. And after this year, it'll be zero for Tesla. General Motors is about to enter the phase-out. They're just short of it. And the other manufacturers are further behind. But, of course, the fact that Tesla is in the phase-out and General Motors is about to be there means that they are turning on the full might of their lobbying muscle to lift or eliminate the cap so that that money can keep flowing. I think that would be an incredibly bad idea for a number of reasons, not the least of which is that these subsidies overwhelmingly go to high-income people. Electric car purchasers, according to IRS data, about 1% made $50,000 or less, the most recent year we have data. 80% make $100,000 or more. And more than half of these purchasers are in a single state, the state of California. And so we've got middle and lower income people subsidizing through the tax code, very, very wealthy people, mostly in one state, which has all kinds of its own subsidies and mandates and so forth, which is why they have so many of the electric vehicle sales. And President Trump has threatened to not lift the cap because he's angry at GM for other unrelated reasons. May not be the best motivation, but if it gets him to the right place on policy, then I'll take it. And I hope that he'll say, look, don't even try to put this in a bill. I'll veto it. And this phase out can take place as scheduled.
In terms of the fact that we even have these subsidies, Phil, a lot of times the federal government will try to encourage research and development by providing such subsidies. But part of the impetus was a concern over our country's reliance on foreign oil at the time. That scenario has changed. So is the rationale for having any of these subsidies still current, still relevant?
It's not. Look, when this was passed, the whole argument for it was we have a national security rationale to incentivize shifting from liquid fuel, petroleum fuel vehicles to electric vehicles because we're dependent on foreign oil and there could be a supply disruption. And it was actually a bipartisan policy. There were Republicans who supported it on that sort of that national security rationale. But it's a very different world. We're not dependent on foreign oil. In fact, we now export more oil than we import. We are a net oil exporter in the United States, which is pretty remarkable when just a few years ago, then President Obama was mocking people who suggested we could ever achieve energy independence, saying we could drill every inch of this country and we would never achieve independence. And he said all kinds of stuff like that. Well, we're just 2 years into President Trump's term here, and we're the number one producer in the world, and we're a net oil exporter. And by the way, the president's not satisfied with that. He said energy independence isn't enough. We want energy dominance. We want to be really the price setter for the world and be the strongest energy producer. And I think you're going to continue to see a ramp up in U.S. production. In fact, the U.S. Geological Survey just surveyed the largest formation, oil and gas formation in the history of the country in western Texas and New Mexico. And so I don't see the oil boom ending anytime soon, which means the logic of subsidizing electric vehicles because of oil import dependency is no longer even remotely applies. In fact, we're in the opposite position of the one that was used to justify putting this subsidy in.
And in fact, Phil, does not the technology that's utilized in these electric cars, doesn't it require certain rare earth minerals that are predominantly found in China and other places and not in the United States? So switching over to these electrical vehicles could make us globally more dependent rather than independent?
Yeah, that's a really good point. These vehicles and the battery systems that they use do depend on rare earth minerals. And right now, we're losing the race for those. We're losing the race for those to China, not just because of Chinese production, but they've entered exclusive arrangements with a lot of countries in Africa and other places where these minerals can be mined. And as much success as we've had in producing more oil and gas in the United States, we're not doing nearly so well where it comes to producing other minerals. And hard rock mining permitting is still a very long and arduous process. And that's something that I think we're going to see a focus from the Trump administration on the next couple of years and trying to streamline that process so we can get some U.S. production on some of those rare earths. But that's a very good point. I mean, to the extent that we're concerned about import dependency and sort of geostrategic implications, there's far more of an issue, far more of an issue now with the electric vehicles because of the minerals that are necessary to produce the battery systems than there is for conventional vehicles, given the U.S.'s dominant position now in producing oil and gas.
Relative to Congress, it would appear, as you've outlined it, that basically if Congress does nothing, these electric vehicle tax credits will phase out. That sounds like a pretty good position because it's a lot easier to get Congress to do nothing than do something. Is that actually the case?
Yes, they'll stick around for a long time because of the way the phase out is designed per manufacturer. So you'll have some of the other competitors to Tesla and GM will be able to say, hey, it qualifies for a federal tax credit. And so, I don't love that from the standpoint of it benefiting some manufacturers over others. But, the ones that already sold their 200,000 vehicles already got that benefit from it. So I'm not going to shed a tear for the, I think, kind of poor design of the subsidy phase out if we can protect it and prevent the cap from being increased or eliminated. And, it's always easier to block something from happening in Congress than it is to do something. And so we're in a relatively good situation to sort of defeat Reagan's famous quip about the closest thing to life on Earth being a government program. That might not be the case for this one if we can block efforts to raise or eliminate that cap. And unfortunately, it'll probably be wrapped into a much larger bill, which would make it difficult to stop. We may see a big package of tax extenders and retroactive tax extenders since they didn't get it done last year, and that's probably where this would sort of hitch a ride. But the president put out a veto threat, that would probably be the end for this. And so it's encouraging that he at least threatened it in a tweet, whether he meant it or whether that was for leverage over something else he wants from General Motors. I'm not sure. But I think this is one where we have a good chance of actually succeeding, just because to succeed, we need only block Congress from acting. And inaction is one of Congress's specialties. So I think we've got a good chance of actually winning this one.
We have been talking with Phil Kirpin. Phil is president of American Commitment. And Phil, tell us a couple of words about American Commitment, where folks can go and find you on the web.
We are a national free market advocacy group. We work on all of the tax, spending, regulatory, fiscal issues, and we try to make it easy for people to know what's happening in Washington on the economic issues and to be more active, engaged citizens. So we've got lots of letter writing opportunities to Congress or to administrative agencies or to the White House, and a lot of information. We try to make it short and to the point so you can understand what we're talking about. And everything is on our website at AmericanCommitment.org.
Phil Kirpin of American Commitment. Phil, thank you for being back with us.
My pleasure, Loma.
Andy Roth is at the Club for Growth, where the new year brings a new majority in the U.S. House of Representatives. Andy, good to have you here.
Hi, thanks for having me, Loman.
So Democrats are now in charge of the U.S. House of Representatives. We officially have divided government in Washington, D.C. What does this mean for the president and his policy agenda going forward, Andy?
Well, actually, I'm on Capitol Hill right now, and with every new Congress, it's a time for all of the new members to get sworn in, all of the lobbyists to swarm their offices immediately to get on a first-name basis with members, and basically for all the corrupt special interest sausage-making to finally get churning again after the rather nice holiday break. But this year is a bit different, as you noted, because the Democrats are now in charge of the House. That means all of the committees are going to change over control. So the Republicans will lose control of the committees like Ways and Means that's in charge of tax policy and trade policy. And then they'll lose control of the Appropriations Committee, which is in charge of spending our money. Although you may not see much of a difference there because Republicans and Democrats both like to spend our money equally with fervor. But the main change is that Nancy Pelosi is now going to be U.S. House Speaker, and they're going to come into D.C. with an agenda. There is a looming budget fight because of the shutdown, but what Pelosi wants to do is get rid of that shutdown fight as quickly as possible so that they can move on with the Democrat agenda. And what that agenda is going to include is an ethics reform package. That's kind of an oxymoron coming from the Democrats, but that will have a lot of things in it, like campaign finance reform, similar to McCain-Feingold. They're going to go after Trump with his tax returns. They're going to go after Trump on the Mueller investigation. There's going to be lots of hearings, lots of investigations, lots of subpoenas, and that's going to take up a majority of the time over the next few months. So gone is deregulation. Gone is tax reform or more tax cuts. Gone is reducing the size of government. Now it's going to be a very combative, divided government. And hopefully that may put a clamp down on spending, but otherwise it's going to be pretty nasty.
So as we look at this, Andy, as you've just outlined, the Republican agenda pretty much grinds to a halt. And the Democrats are taking power in the House with an agenda of their own, but Republicans increased their majority in the U.S. Senate, and you still have President Trump sitting out there with a veto pen. So practically speaking, are the Democrats going to be able to enact any of their agenda any more than Republicans can enact theirs?
No, they won't be, and that's a good observation. What's going to happen is that Democrats know this too, so they're doing it merely for the theater. They want all voters, particularly their voters, to know exactly what they stand for, what they're striving to do, so that in the 2020 election, including the presidential election, they have something to campaign on, saying that they did this, that, and the other. But you're correct. Whatever the House Democrats pass, it's not going to pass the Republican-controlled Senate. That's the good news. The bad news is that when it comes to the budget, and when it comes to spending, as we've seen in the past, the way that they'll resolve things is probably just spend more money on both parties' priorities so that the taxpayer is the ultimate loser. My hope is that that's not the case, but past is prologue, so we'll just have to see what happens.
As we look at this then, as you've mentioned, the Democrats are pretty much just going to put on a show. However, they're going to go up against the master showman, who is Donald Trump. And are they really going to be able to outshine Donald Trump in that arena? He seems to be able to command whatever attention whenever he wants.
Well, I think the shutdown fight is a great example of that. It's unclear, given that we've been in holiday fog for the last couple of weeks, it's unclear what the effect this shutdown is going to have on popular opinion or on public opinion. And so it's not quite understood who's winning this shutdown fight. The Democrats are going to offer up a shutdown proposal. It's going to get countered by Trump, and ultimately I think we'll get out of it. It's just who's going to win and who's going to get the blame. However that ends, I think we're going to see that as fuel or as trepidation going forward for both parties. I think everybody is kind of walking on eggshells because they know that even though the 2018 elections just ended, the 2020 elections feel right around the corner. And so everybody's going to be grandstanding. Everybody's going to be talking about who's running for president. And that's going to dominate all of these conversations.
Since the government shutdown, which is actually only a very partial shutdown, Andy, doesn't really affect most people in the country, probably Washington, D.C.-based government employees more than anybody else, who are obviously not a Donald Trump constituency. So in terms of Donald Trump's base or the persuadables that he might want, the shutdown isn't really affecting them. So is this a case of where the president can afford to, as he put it, own the shutdown, just sit tight, and ultimately try to force the Democrats into some sort of compromise on this border wall?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question, right? Or the trillion-dollar question is, how is the public going to respond to this shutdown, this partial shutdown, as you said? One theory is that we've had so many shutdowns recently that I think the public is becoming inoculated to them, and they realize that they're not the huge tragedy that Obama and others have made out of this in previous past. Just because the national monuments may be closed or because the Department of Commerce can't release some sort of statistic about some economic event because they're not there to do it, I don't think that that's really affecting people's livelihoods.
We will certainly keep an eye on what's happening with the government shutdown. And also, as the budget battle continues in Washington, D.C., we have been talking with Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, as always, a couple of words about the club.
You bet. The Club for Growth is a membership organization out of Washington, D.C., but we have over 250,000 members from all across the country, from all walks of life, and we're united because we believe in economic freedom. If your listeners are interested, they can go to our website at www.clubforgrowth.org, and if they like what they see, they can join for free.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
When is an engineer not an engineer? A professional licensure board in Oregon took a rather narrow view of that designation, but in the process, violated free speech rights. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details from Sam Gedge of the Institute for Justice.
Mats Jarlstrom is an engineer, and now he can actually say that he's an engineer without getting in trouble with the state government in Oregon. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine, and you're listening to American Radio Journal. Let me be the last to wish you a happy new year. And as we head into 2019, we're taking a look and updating, actually, a story that we've covered a few times in the past right here on American Radio Journal, because we have some good news to share. Mats Jarlstrom has won a lawsuit against the state of Oregon, specifically against the Oregon Board of Engineers, which had, and this is just so ridiculous, it had told him that he could not say he was an engineer, even though he's obviously an engineer. He has degrees. He's worked in the Air Force, the Swedish Air Force, as an engineer. There's no doubt that he knows what he's talking about, but the Oregon State Board of Engineer Examiners says he can't say that publicly, which, of course, seems like a violation of the First Amendment. And this week, a federal judge said, yes, indeed, it does violate the First Amendment. So joining me now to talk about this case and the big win this week is Sam Gedge. He's an attorney with the Institute for Justice. IJ represented Mats in this legal matter, and Sam was one of the attorneys on the case. Sam, thanks for taking some time and being here on the show with us.
Happy to be here.
So let's go back and start at the beginning. Sam here, for anybody who may not be familiar with Mats' story, this whole thing, this whole saga started way back in 2013 when his wife, I think it was, got a traffic ticket.
That's right. Mats Jarlstrom, originally from Sweden, and he's kind of a math and science guy. He has an engineering background, and he's fascinated by how things work. So in 2013, after his wife got a red light camera ticket in their hometown, he got really fascinated in exactly what the math is behind how yellow traffic lights are timed. So he looked into it, he studied it, and he decided that the standard formula for timing these traffic lights is incomplete. So, you know, he did what any kind of entrepreneurial guy would do with a math and science background. He came up with a new formula, and he started talking about it, started telling people about it.
Yeah, so Matt started talking to people about it, and actually got a fair bit of attention, if I'm not mistaken. He was on 60 Minutes at one point, and he got asked to present his findings at a conference for traffic engineers. But then he caught the attention of this board in Oregon, where he lives, and tell us what happened there.
So things kind of took a weird turn. A little time after Matt started looking into this, he actually emailed Oregon's Engineering Licensing Board, among a bunch of other, you know, media outlets and government officials, basically said, I'm a Swedish engineer, I have these ideas about traffic light timing, you know, I'm excited about this, you guys might be interested in it too. And the board responded kind of surprisingly by saying, we don't actually care about your ideas, which is fine, they don't have to. But they also said, you're not allowed to call yourself an engineer. That word is off limits to anybody who is not an Oregon licensed professional engineer. And that really triggered a multi-year ordeal for Matt, because the board ended up launching about a two-year investigation against him and fined him $500, both for calling himself an engineer, using the word engineer, and also just for talking about his traffic light theories without a license.
This is one of those stories that just infuriates libertarians, and really I think it should infuriate anybody on so many levels. I mean, it starts with red light cameras, and of course there's lots of issues with those. They're often used as a way to raise revenue rather than as a legitimate tool of traffic safety. And then there's the Occupational Licensing Board going after someone who is clearly not a threat to the health or safety of anyone in Oregon. I mean, it's not like Matz was practicing medicine on someone without a license here. In fact, he wasn't even practicing engineering in a professional way, but the board gets involved and they try to fine him and tell him what he can do or can't do. And then eventually all of this really ends up being a First Amendment issue once you get past all those other issues here. That's the big thing here, is that this is ultimately a question of free speech.
That's exactly right. And that, in the end, is what the court ruled last week. The court said that, of course, Matz can call himself an engineer. You know, he can use that word just like, you know, anybody else can use that word. And more broadly, the court said that the state of Oregon just cannot, consistent with the First Amendment, cannot set this word off limits to all these people who are engineers but who may not happen to have an Oregon-issued license.
Yeah, and a big win for the Institute for Justice, another big win for you guys. We are talking with one of IJ's attorneys, Sam Gedge, and I am Eric Boehm, and you are listening to American Radio Journal. Sam, one of the really amazing things about the story really interested me in covering this case is the fact that this was not really a one-off situation, and the federal judge who issued the ruling this week alluded to this in her decision. This Oregon Board of Engineers actually has a pretty long track record of doing this sort of thing, of investigating and fining people who are merely describing themselves as engineers, maybe in like a professional bio, or in one case, I think it was like a politician, his official bio on his website. These people are not practicing the craft of being an engineer. And Matz was really just the latest in a long line of victims here.
That's exactly right. And for me, that was kind of one of the most breathtaking parts of the case, because you're right, Matz's story was not unique. For years, this board had really operated under the radar and just investigated, you know, I think dozens of people simply for truthfully describing themselves as engineers in speech as varied as, you know, political advertisements, people opposing ballot initiatives. At one point, board members joked about taking down Dilbert because, you know, the cartoon software engineer isn't licensed in the state of Oregon. So these people really did take this unconstitutional law and really abused it to the hilt.
It's a great example of a licensing board that's just gone completely rogue. And as you say, Sam, really abused their power. Matz may have been the latest victim, but he is hopefully going to be the last victim thanks to this fine work by the Institute for Justice, and a big win, I think, for the First Amendment this week. Sam, we are unfortunately out of time. Thanks again for everything you've done. Thanks for being here. And thanks to your colleagues at IJ who do this sort of thing every day.
Thanks so much.
And again, that is Sam Gedge. He's an attorney with the Institute for Justice. You can read more about IJ's work and about their victory on behalf of Matz Jarlstrom at IJ.org. Check out our coverage of the case over at Reason.com. And for Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. We'll catch you right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
The impeachment and ultimate failure of the U.S. Senate to remove President Bill Clinton from office played out 20 years ago. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College discusses lessons learned on this American Radio Journal commentary.
20 years ago, America experienced the impeachment of a president. The vote took place December 19, 1998, with two articles approved by the House of Representatives. The first on grounds that President Bill Clinton lied to a grand jury, and the second on grounds that Clinton obstructed justice. The Senate trial began on January 7, 1999. A two-thirds vote, or 67 senators, was required to remove Clinton from office. And yet, it wasn't even close, as not a single Democrat from Clinton's party voted for Senate removal. How did it come about? What lessons can we learn today, especially as members of the incoming Democrat-controlled House vowed to impeach Donald Trump? The path to Bill Clinton's impeachment began on January 17, 1998, with Clinton giving a sworn deposition flatly denying a sexual relationship with White House intern Monica Lewinsky. The deposition took 6 hours. Among the curiosities was the president's striking amnesia over seven women listed as various Jane Does. All were women that Bill Clinton, retroactive father of the Me Too movement, employed as sexual receptacles, on company time and usually with the assistance of the state. The deposition included complex discourses over what the master of the parsed word considered to be sexual relations. What Clinton told Judge Susan Weber Wright was a rehearsal of what he soon tried to shovel to a much larger audience. And that came to pass when, on January 26, speaking in the Roosevelt Room of the White House, Clinton doubled down. Standing between his wife and his vice president, joining him in announcing their new after-school initiative, Clinton looked at his audience and glared, "I want you to listen to me. I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky. I never told anybody to lie, not a single time, never. These allegations are false." With that, he stomped away. The president's performance was impressive, calling to mind a trenchant assessment by fellow Democrat Nebraska Senator Bob Kerry. "Clinton's an unusually good liar. Unusually good." Clinton would be forced to fess up only when it was later learned that that woman, Miss Lewinsky, had a blue dress with stains on it, the distinctive DNA of William Jefferson Clinton. Bill was busted. As liberal pundit Chris Matthews put it, he didn't decide to tell the truth. He got caught. Monica would later tell it all. She now concedes that her 50-something boss had engaged in a gross abuse of power. Yeah? What sort? Well, there were 18 months of gifts and at least a half dozen sexual encounters between Bill and Monica, one with Bill maneuvering a favorite cigar as a sexual instrument. They occurred between November 15, 1995 and March 29, 1997, the peak of Bill Clinton's reelection campaign. The first took place the same day Clinton signed a Family Week proclamation. One of the most infamous, while Bill was on the phone with a congressman, occurred Easter Sunday in 1996, after Bill returned from church. What to make of the whole sordid mess? The most respected voice in the impeachment proceedings was Congressman Henry Hyde. "It's not a question of sex," said Hyde in his floor speech before the historic vote. "It's a question of lying under oath. The issue is perjury, obstruction of justice." Well, actually, it was all those things. Bill Clinton had a sexual problem as well as a legal problem. But when it comes to impeachment, the terms are subjective, and they easily succumb to partisan lines. That was precisely what happened in this case 20 years ago, and it is likely to happen again with President Donald Trump. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Check out my latest book, A Pope and a President, on John Paul II and Ronald Reagan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country. They include our newest affiliates, KIRC-FM, KSLE-FM, and KWSH-AM in Shawnee, Oklahoma. Welcome to our new listeners in the Sooner State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of interviews aired on our program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.